So the tape can roll. I'm Paul Menzel from BLU, and this session is entitled Heavy Drinking, Are Alcoholics Diseased? And I want to say right at the start that I haven't worked on this problem for a long time. I haven't written anything on it. I don't regard myself as anything more than an amateur on this issue, but I thought it was a very interesting topic. Given that I had read a few things, particularly Herbert Fingeret's book, which is in the bookstore and out in paperback now, Heavy Drinking, The Myth of Alcoholism as Disease. Fingeret is a philosopher who, about a decade or so ago, in his work over the sort of middle decades of his life, did a lot of work with what you might call psychiatry, trying to determine the extent to which psychiatric disorders were diseases, the extent to which there was still free will or and responsibility or not in certain kinds of individuals with them. But he hadn't written anything on alcoholism, as far as I can tell, until about the last 10 years. But at any rate, this was an interesting book to me, and what I thought I would do is just present some of the essential ideas of the book, because it is very provocative. Then moderately try to defend it, point out a few weaknesses that maybe he can reply to, maybe he can't, and then we'll just have a general free-roaming discussion about it. And I'm don't mistake me, just because I'm presenting Fingeret's view doesn't mean that I think Fingeret is right, though I'll try, for purposes of discussion stimulation, to defend him a bit, at least. The issue has a larger importance, I think, in social thinking about medicine for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's been a lot written on the over-medicalization of contemporary American life. Now, a lot of it falls into what might be called extreme viewpoint category, but there's a lot of it that doesn't, too. The one that's probably the author's most famous here, who holds an extreme view, but who I don't regard as an extremist in the sense of not holding a plausible view at all, is Ivan Illich. In his book Medical Nemesis, 15 years ago or so, argued that in fact the healthcare system, that healthcare as a whole entity, an enterprise in most Western societies, actually harmed people more than it helped people. Not because it gives you diseases when you go into a hospital, or not because physicians take out the wrong thing when they're supposed to take when they do surgery, but because primarily, that too, I mean some of those things too, but primarily because it leads the whole culture to say that what's wrong with them is something with their body, which is not their primary immediate responsibility. So you get this passive reaction to the disease. The whole notion of a disease gets overblown in Illich's mind. So that whole business of the over-medicalization of life is certainly one theme that Fingeret wants to grab hold of. I mean, he wants to make the same charge. Not in general. He doesn't hold the view in general at all, like Illich does. But in particular, in relation to the classification of alcoholism as something that there should be a medical treatment for, because it is, after all, a disease. He will come to the conclusion that there should not primarily be medical treatments for alcoholism. He will draw that conclusion after he's argued he thinks that it's not a disease. The other interesting and more enduring question in this, of course, is just individual responsibility, a long-standing idea and theme, very hard to work to define precisely. Philosophers have spent centuries trying to say exactly what constitutes the freedom of the person, if there is freedom of the person. And there is no consensus on that, and so this is one area in philosophy of medicine where the responsibility, the individual responsibility theme comes out very clearly. Well, on to Fingeret's view. Fingeret starts by defining what the classic disease concept of alcoholism is. Now, his case isn't necessarily dependent on just a verbal definition here, but And I'll note that at a couple of points, but at least it's partly dependent on that. And one reply, of course, to Fingeret would be, you got the wrong notion of disease here. But this is the way he defines And he makes clear that this is not a revisionist notion of alcoholism as a disease. This is the classic notion of alcoholism as a disease. That it is, first of all, a specific disease with a biological basis to which some people are vulnerable. Not all people who drink, but some people who drink. Or maybe some people who don't drink are vulnerable to this disease. First of all. Secondly, that those who are vulnerable will develop the disease if they drink. Thirdly, that normal social drinking leads inevitably to private drink, to a combination of, not necessarily all three of these, private drinking, increased tolerance, and withdrawal distress, distress upon the attempt to withdraw. This one is the optional one. It may not include the first one, but it definitely includes the latter two. The progression from normal social drinking, the inevitable progression from normal social drinking to private drinking, increased tolerance of alcohol, and distress upon withdrawal is inevitable and ends in a loss of control, specifically a loss of control over drinking more than one drink after one has had the first drink. So one cannot resist having the second drink once one in a situation has the first drink. That's the specific kind of loss of control that is involved. Now, fifthly, under that loss of control, the person hits bottom and either then ends up in total physical and mental breakdown or major physical functional breakdown and often eventually death from alcohol use. Or there's a radical conversion of sorts, namely abstinence, which can come about by treatment by a number of different ways. It could be by medical treatment. But abstinence is the only way out of this road toward total breakdown. The disease is treatable, but even if one, through personal effort or medical treatment or whatever, even if it is treated, and one avoids the terrible loss of control because one avoids the first drink, that you still have the disease. It's never fully cured. Although I think there would be different versions of the definition of the notion of alcoholism as a classic disease on that score. Finger immediately notes that there's a certain paradox here, which I think the defenders of the notion could respond to. The paradox Fingeret says is, if it's a disease, isn't there also a loss of control over whether to take the first drink? But the whole way you get out of the loss of control in taking the first drink is just not to take the first drink. So Fingeret would charges that if in fact it's truly a disease, it would compel the person to take the first drink too, once they've got the disease. But it doesn't, so it can't be a disease. Now, it's not a point really essential, I think, to his case. And he makes the point, but I think it's simply a wrong point. Because one could define the disease as simply the condition which would trigger loss of control if one took the first drink. That could still have a biological basis, for one thing. And I don't see anything in the notion of a disease that would prevent us calling that condition, the condition under which we did have control until we took the first drink, but once we took the first drink, even after we had the fully developed disease, which we would still have freedom to take the first drink, but after we took the first drink, we would have no freedom. In fact, I think little rests on the point, because Fingeret's main attack on this this classic conception of alcoholism as a disease is, well, one of his main attacks at least, is contemporary up-to-date data, he says, about the actual behavior of people who are classified as alcoholics. Now, all these studies would assume that we know who an alcoholic is that we're studying and then come forth with the data, but and that, of course, the studies may have wrong. But he claims and cites innumerable articles and numerous other authorities in this, that there are two pieces of data that seem that defeat claim 4. Namely, that some people who allegedly are alcoholics do sometimes, not very often perhaps, but sometimes, drink once and not second time. It depends on the conditions. The study, he claims the studies show, that no study has shown that the people regarded as the hardest core classic alcoholics always take a second drink once they take a first drink. It depends on the conditions they're in. But then he says, if it depends on the conditions they're in, one ought to look at the conditions they're in when they do take a second drink, after they take the drink, as the cause of their second, of their downhill slide, not some disease that controls them once they take the first drink. One needs to look at the conditions. Another thing he notes about the data is that alcoholics, in a number of studies apparently show that, and I don't know the scientific literature, I'm only reporting what he says. A number of studies show that alcoholics adjust their drinking by a number of different factors, including the simple one of the price of alcohol. The demand for alcohol by an alcoholic is not completely price inelastic. It is partially elastic. Now that itself, Fingerette claims, shows that the fourth condition is defeated. And you can adjust a number of other things too that will result in the alcoholic not taking a second drink after they've taken the first. Secondly, he claims, and in his attack on this position, that if the loss of control is only a suppose someone comes back and says, well, it's not a complete loss of control, it's only very great difficulty. That's what the disease is. It's very great difficulty. Then his reply is, well, if it's very great difficulty, then the disease, what we sort of say then is the disease doesn't explain anything. Because what explains whether people then take the second drink is the conditions that determine whether the difficulty was so great that they couldn't resist or whether it wasn't. It's not the disease that is determining things. And he thinks, in fact, one would begin to retract the hypothesis that there was any underlying disease here if one filled in, got an understanding sufficiently of all the other conditions that led to, in one case, and other conditions that didn't lead to taking the second drink after alcoholics had taken the first drink. And this, of course, he makes very clear, would vary from person to person. These conditions aren't universal across alcoholics at all. One of his main claims here is that it's not likely that alcoholism is a disease because the conditions under which people will not take alcoholics will not take the second drink once they take the first drink vary a lot. And therefore, I'll get to this point more positively. He calls it the heavy use of alcohol a way of life that intersects with all sorts of other personal contingencies and idiosyncrasies that give the person their identity and their environment. It just happens to be a very destructive one. Thirdly, he says that there are difficulties about the whole notion of withdrawal. If in fact there is this very strong withdrawal distress and what one might call the craving for alcohol when one attempts to withdraw, he claims then there would be a puzzle. Because, first of all, why would the person have to drink heavily a lot before this withdrawal distress phenomenon came on the scene? Probably there's an easy reply to that. Well, it just takes a while for the disease to develop, one might say. But then he makes a second point. Why would the alcoholic not stop after a few drinks that in fact alleviate the withdrawal distress? The withdrawal point doesn't add anything really to it doesn't make the loss of control point. It doesn't explain why there's loss of control, and furthermore, the data tend to show that withdrawal distress is not something that can't be overcome, that on occasion alcoholics overcome it. Otherwise, in fact, the treatment of abstinence or the recommendation of abstinence wouldn't even be possible. Well, at any rate, that's his negative case. His positive case is interesting, and I'll read just three short passages that I think nicely state his positive case. On any particular occasion, the heavy drinker may drink heavily or moderately, or may not drink at all, or may start drinking and then voluntarily stop. The choice depends on upon situational factors, such as the drinker's mood and feelings of frustration, satisfaction, and threat, and the social setting. The choice also depends on the rewards or deprivations the drinker believes will ensue, on his or her beliefs about the effects the alcohol will produce, and so on. All the reasons and motives that affect anyone's decisions about personal conduct. In addition, the choice depends upon cultural, ethnic, religious, regional, and occupational factors, on social class and dynamics, age, and marital status. He goes to some other societies, and in particular to, sort of in a very general way, to early American, colonial American society, as an example where there was oodles of drinking, but apparently very little alcoholism. It's a different cultural and occupational setting. Thus, on any particular occasion, the drinker's choice will be influenced by the sorts of things that generally influence all of us. What is heavy drinking? He calls it a central way of life and explains it this way. Says, in fact, it's rather parallel to being a professor. Extremely difficult to get out of, and interrelated to countless different factors in one's life. It's just that the alcoholic's way of life is a destructive way of life, and presumably a professor's way is not. For the person challenged by personal problems, heavy drinking is one of the culturally available responses, however imprudent and self-destructive. Thus, instead of positing an invisible breakdown in the machinery of self-control, we must start to look at heavy drinkers as people who are living, sometimes obliviously, sometimes quite consciously and painfully, with the consequences and ramifications of one of their central activities. Instead of viewing heavy drinkers as the helpless victims of a disease, we should come to see their drinking as a meaningful, however destructive, part of their struggle to live their lives. Changing our type of career or our style of social life, deciding to do some serious reading instead of watching TV or whatever, to worry less about ourselves and more about others, to eat less, to save more, all these require changes in all sorts of other routines, attitudes, and ways of behaving, even if we desire the end result of the proposed change. Higher salary, trimmer figure, more security, a better quality of life, the change suddenly seems far more disruptive than we could have imagined. At this point, we may feel in the grip of some alien opposing power that is trying to prevent us from doing what we rationally want to do. Like any of us, contemplating a major change in a central activity, the heavy drinker cannot simply reshape his or her life at will. Of course, neither are we helpless to reshape our lives in significant ways. What I have to do, if not I, who? Is to take responsibility within the limits imposed by my life for selecting and achieving realistic goals. There are no guarantees, no techniques or treatments that assuredly work for all. This is basic common sense, not anything peculiar to heavy drinkers. And then he goes on to, in fact, restate that his view is not a moralistic view, that though it makes the alcoholic responsible for getting out, it recognizes that it is extremely difficult to get out. It's just that it's not a disease and that it involves more an assessment of all sorts of environmental and personal situations in the person's life and not a medical treatment. In particular, he notes a study about ant abuse, which allegedly showed that a small, pharmacologically ineffective amount, it was a small amount of ant abuse, but it was at least was supposed, assumed by the study, to be so small that it wouldn't affect the person. The person was told it was ant abuse in an effective amount, but it was a very tiny amount. We'd call it a placebo. My first question about this study was, why didn't they use a sugar pill? But at any rate, this study apparently showed that apparently this very tiny and pharmacologically ineffective, that's what the study said, pharmacologically ineffective amount of ant abuse produced equally high abstinence rates, showing that it's the belief that you're taking this that cures you, not the ant abuse itself.
But that doesn't make any sense, because the taking of ant abuse, you take it because you are afraid if you drink you'll become violently ill. So it doesn't matter if, because it's the fear that keeps you from drinking and not the drug itself. So that's a very irrelevant point.
It's the fear that keeps you from, well, his point is that it's the first.
The antabuse does not keep you from drinking. It's the fear that if you drink, you will become violently ill, which is what antabuse does.
Keeps you from becoming violently ill.
Antabuse doesn't make you not want to drink. Yeah.
So the dosage doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. It's just the assumption that you're taking it and that you will then get sick if you drink that keeps you from drinking.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The antabuse isn't meant to take away your craving or anything like that.
It's just meant to prevent you from becoming violent.
No, it makes you sick.
Oh, it makes you sick, so you don't. It's a kind of icy.
You are told that, and you perhaps are shown somebody heaving their guts out because they drank on
antabuse. Or you've had experience taking in the past and then drinking it, so you don't want that to happen again. Right.
But this study apparently showed that even the tiny, tiny amount of antabuse, if the person thought it was an effective amount, would produce the same results.
Of course it would, because
they would be afraid of it. It's the fear, it's not the drug. So,
right.
So antabuse is already, I mean, the very point of antabuse is that it works like a placebo.
It works through a conception
of what's going to happen. It doesn't work pharmacologically.
No.
Yeah.
Except that it is what he's saying in his study, the people that took the very small amounts of antabuse, when they took it and drank, they became ill.
Yes, that's what the study apparently showed. They became ill and were equally and then equally abstinent as the group that took the full dose of antabuse.
But most people don't drink when they take antabuse. They just quit taking it if they want to.
Yeah. Well, his point was it's the mental conception, the will. It's a mental view, not any pharmacological effect.
Yeah, right.
And therefore, he thinks this adds evidence to the claim that alcoholism is not a biological disease. I'm not sure that conclusion follows. At any rate, as far as AA, he also notes that it's that the statistics that show that people in AA stay abstinent can be challenged on because AA won't let you stay in AA if you're not abstinent. So that it's a question of whether you're in AA because you're abstinent or whether you're abstinent because you're in AA. And he says we don't know which is which. He faults AA, obviously, for using this slogan, one drink, one drunk, and believing and propounding the claim that you're absolutely out of control once you take one drink, which he thinks is the central falsehood in the classic notion of alcoholism as a disease. But he says AA is absolutely on the right track. It's one of the few treatment groups that conceives of alcoholism as a way of life, not just a disease, and treats it as a way of life because the whole business of being in AA becomes a way of life, and that's why it's effective. So he recommends that we, in fact, not ditch AA's approach, just their scientific or philosophical claim about a disease and about a total loss of control. And he also recommends then that we stop searching for a medical cure for alcoholism because he doubts that there is a disease for which there can be a medical cure, that maybe we should still continue to entertain the hypothesis, but generally we shouldn't think that's where success is going to lie. He could be more cautious in that claim. I think what he should say is, if the rest of his case is right, is continue some research money on medical cures for alcoholism, but don't put the bulk of your treatment types or the bulk of your research money into an avenue that makes the assumption that it's a biologically based disease for which there will be a medical cure. Instead, he says, turn to all kinds of personal, interpersonal assessments, including pastors, etc. So, the one objection that I have read to his whole notion about the whole claim that there isn't compulsion after one takes a drink is, I think, quite interesting. It's that the compulsive element is not in the thing we usually focus on in compulsion, namely that the person can't resist. One analyst of this, in criticizing Fingerette that I read, says the compulsive part of alcoholism is not taking, does not come between the first drink and the second drink in terms of desire so strong that it can't be resisted. Instead, the compulsive element is in abnormal cognitive states, namely that the alcoholic is involved in a self-deception, an avoidance of certain realities about what is going to happen, that are very abnormal, that most people are not, most people face up to realities more, and that it's the cognitive state of the alcoholic that constitutes the inability of the alcoholic to refuse a second drink once they take a first drink. It's kind of an odd view, but I think, though it doesn't maybe make sense of the second drink connection with the first drink, one could revamp the whole notion of compulsion and see it not as a force of desire in the alcoholic, but a state of their awareness. That's the compulsive part. And then when, of course, there is, if that's true, the treatment would be changing, significantly changing their state of awareness. Then they would not be locked in a state of compulsion anymore. And could escape.
Oh, I'm lost on that. Can you take me back? Can you, maybe if you talk like you're the alcoholic, I'm lost.
What will happen if I take the second drink? Oh, this time, not anything that bad. You know, I've done it before, and, you know, I make it home, and, well, look at your family situation, or what's going to happen in your job? Well, I can get along without that. I mean, there's a lot of self-deception. What this commentator is saying is there's tremendous amount of self-deception about the results of heavy drinking in alcoholics. And that's what leads to their inability to behave differently. It's not any force of desire that's got control of them. It's a cognitive flaw.
How is that any different than the confusion about the first drink? Well, I mean, the person obviously has had some experience drinking before. You assume. So why is the self-deception that you just described any different than the self-deception that says, well, I can just take one drink. I'll just have one tonight, I'll just have one drink, and I know I can stop with one drink.
That would be included. That would count as a self-deception, but this,
and to me, that's
this commentator,
that's a classic alcoholic notion. Or any heavy drinker notion. Tonight, I'll just have one drink. And I
but this commentator would say that though that's a kind of self-deception, the person probably won't stop once they have a drink. The compulsiveness is not between the first drink and the second drink. The compulsiveness results from that cognition that they once that leads them to take the first drink, plus a number of other cognitive misbeliefs that don't give them the courage not to take the second drink. He just opts out. This is a way of saying it's not a total loss of control, but there's a compulsiveness that's a result of a state of awareness. I don't find the view all that easy to understand either, but it's an attempt to redirect the whole notion of compulsiveness and say that alcoholics are still in a state of compulsion. It's just different than this iron fist force of desire that we tend to conceive of compulsiveness is constituted.
So then you're saying this commentator is really saying that it's not the person that becomes compulsive, it's the circumstances around them that makes him compulsive. And it's not the person himself that becomes the alcoholic, but it's the alcohol that he puts in his body that makes him an alcoholic.
Well, so there's Fingerette, whom I've been talking about for 25 minutes, and then there's this critic who says that Fingerette's got the point of compulsion in alcoholism wrong. Fingerette thinks that the difficulty in breaking alcoholic behavior is a result of the tremendously complex network that that the drinking behavior is involved in the person's life, and that the causes of it are just a whole host of things. Personal problems, the family situation, et cetera, and of course the fact that drinking fulfills some positive roles. That would be key to Fingerette's explanation of why it's difficult for an alcoholic to stop. But so then Fingerette's response is, alcoholics and people who treat them should never say that that constitutes loss of control. It's not loss of control, it's just a complex problem. It's like the other complex problems people have, only it's probably more destructive. And we should see alcohol, it's not a disease flaw. And that itself might be correctable in non-medical ways. But it's not, but the critic says Fingerette's wrong in placing the alcoholic on the same psychological level as the rest of us.
Right? Well, my problem with that whole book is that it seems to me, I think he has a valid point in some ways, but I think that he set up a paper tiger and has slashed it to pieces, and in the process is undermining what has been a very important advancement in the treatment of alcoholism. All of us who are our age and older know that there was a time when alcoholism was seen and treated legally as crime, when it was seen and treated morally as sin, and handled through the church it as sin. Neither one of those two approaches helped one whit. They did not work. AA came along and discovered that the way to treat alcoholism was as a spiritual disease. That as Jung says, it was the spirit against the spirits. That somehow something happens within one that only this kind of spiritual path can take. And the term disease was used as metaphor to take it out of the legal arena and take it out of the moral arena. Mm-hmm. And so as metaphor, it was put upon alcoholism. And it was never talked about, at least originally, as disease in the same way that catching the flu is a disease that needs a pill to treat. Hospitals latched on to because they started having declining patient things. Insurance companies paid for it. They opened up huge wings. They took in millions of dollars in the treatment of alcoholism, which would not have had to happen in a hospital. I mean, the best treatment centers are often not hospital-based treatment centers, and the earliest ones were never hospital.
And one really shouldn't call their treatment medical treatment either.
No, it's not medical treatment. That does not necessarily mean insurance companies shouldn't pay for it, but it shouldn't have to happen in a hospital. It shouldn't have to be supervised by medical doctors who don't know anything about it anyway, mostly. And then to come out, and a lot of stuff is being written now like this. And what it's doing, I fear, is to throw alcoholism back into the arena of morality and to condemn the alcoholic as weak and lay a guilt trip on the alcoholic that is what is probably causing the alcoholic to drink anyway.
Fingerette tries very hard in some follow-up articles where he's been attacked for precisely mm-hmm. that to say, hey, you've got me completely wrong. Mm-hmm. I think if you're correct, he's got some of the history of the development of the notion of disease wrong, too. But in relation to the charge that this would be a step backward because it would be opening the door to moralisms again and making alcoholism criminal, then he would say absolutely not.
And there's nothing in AA that disavows the sense of a person taking control of himself.
No, but all he disputes about AA,
yeah.
The only thing he disputes is that the withdrawal distress removes the ability to control, which he says AA, if they think about it, will say they don't claim anyhow, mm-hmm. because they claim you can go through withdrawal distress and still resist the first drink. The main thing he disputes in AA is this loss of control between the first and second drink. Mm-hmm. And he says, and his case there is entirely scientific. He just says the studies that have been done on whether in fact that claim is true, whether the people we think are classic alcoholics mm-hmm. always take a second drink once they take the first, every study has shown the claim doesn't hold up. Mm-hmm. And that AA must do something to revise its approach, although it may be a small element.
And AA has thought about this at great length. And once you open the door, alcoholics being who they are, they're all going to jump through it. You know, that's
well,
the problem.
No, well,
you
finger
know,
up with
it might be that 10 alcoholics out of 100 can drink enough.
In other words, the truth doesn't work.
No.
The only most successful treatment is premised on a falsehood. We know it's false, but we should still keep
Well, we know that it's false in what, 10%, 15% of the cases. That some people can control themselves some of the time.
No, he says all the studies show
that some
that every alcoholic will sometimes not take a second drink once they've taken the first.
Yeah. But how long is he saying that will happen? Is that months, years before?
All he says, he just says, whenever it happens, whether it's very often, very long, what it shows is that there is not total loss of control between once one takes the first drink.
Yeah. But see, in the mind of an alcoholic, they take one drink, and they say, okay, now I've proven to myself I can take one drink. So a week later, they'll say, okay, I can take one drink, because I proved it last time, because I didn't drink after the first drink. I mean, there's incredible mental games that alcoholics play with themselves. So if they were a part of the study, it would have shown that, yes, they could take one drink. But what they're doing is playing a game with themselves. And maybe they'll do it 10 times to prove to themselves that they can, like we have an alcoholic person in our congregation that goes through Lent and doesn't drink every year to prove that he's not an alcoholic.
I think what Fingerette would want alcoholics to do is be able to understand what the circumstances are in which, if they do take one drink, they're not going to be able to resist the second drink. So that they start adjusting their life and only take the first drink in situations where they're confident they won't. Now, maybe the honesty for a particular alcoholic is to say, hey, I don't know with sufficient confidence what those situations are, even though they probably occur and would compose the full explanation of why I take the second drink upon once I take the first, but I can't understand it, so the better rule of thumb is abstinence. Fingerette isn't arguing against that. He notes that abstinence is not necessarily a bad policy. It's the idea behind it that he wants to dispute, especially as it drives the notion in our society that alcoholism is a disease which fuels medical treatments, which may not be the best treatments, but are funded and people buy because they've got this word medical, and because people see alcoholism as a disease, which they ought to go to the medical people for instead of going to the pastors.
So he's on
a campaign to broaden out the response to alcoholics, not to moralize it, to broaden it out. In some ways, it's almost to get even further away from moralism than the classic disease concept, because he wants to put alcoholism on the level with us, and note that we've got a lot of situations like this where there's tremendous difficulty too, and where you have to be very honest about the complex interrelationship between an activity that you're trying to change and other things. So he would argue, I think, that that getting rid of the notion of disease, and especially getting rid of the notion of medical treatments as the secret to changing behavior, will make a more tolerant, sympathetic, compassionate society for alcoholics to relate to.
So would he say then that a person, say, given the right set of life circumstances, might not ever be tempted to take that second drink if they were not presented with the life circumstances in which they felt a compulsion to escape those life circumstances?
Fingerette's first question to an alcoholic is, what What need does drinking fulfill in your life? And if we can get a handle on it, there's not an easy answer to that. There'll be a very complex answer to that in most cases. There won't be just a one-line answer. But if we can get a handle on what that is, the many needs that are fulfilled by drinking, then we start to get some real progress. You see, Finger Out wants to hold out the possibility here. Maybe he's the idealist. Wants to hold out the possibility that an alcoholic can be fully cured, not just treated.
So the compulsion then is to avoid one's circumstances in life then. It's not a physical...
Or to see, have other things in life to fulfill the needs that alcohol currently fulfills.
Right.
The person who was very comfortable with being a heavy drinker, and other people may have a problem with it, but the drinker does not have this conflict when you're talking about the second or third and can I get. They're very comfortable with being able to drink and have a lot of drinks and to be drunk. And I still go to work, I still get up, I still, I don't beat my kids. And Ed McMahon did it on television. He said, people talk about my drinking, I have never missed a day of work, so let that speak for itself, right? I'm not an alcoholic.
He doesn't comment specifically about that, but I suspect that he would say that there are lots of things that are very difficult to change that are heavy. They're intricately interwoven with all sorts of other needs and factors in our lives, and alcoholism isn't different than all of those, except that it's very destructive. So if it's not destructive, then why do anything about it? Instead of saying, well, if it's not destructive, there's still something wrong, there's a disease which we ought to treat. I suspect that he doesn't address it. I can't remember him addressing, but I suspect he'd say precisely, leave the person alone.
It's almost like the question of, is there a sound if a tree falls in the woods if there's no one there to hear it? In this situation, it's not hurting him, but what about... disease or problem or whatever when it's affecting someone else?
Certainly many times when heavy alcohol users think they're not engaging in any destructive behavior, still are.
Well, if he drives home from the studio, if that's where he's drinking, it affects me.
Or they may deny that spending all the time drinking or being under certain states of diminished awareness after work are destructive, but in fact they still are, just not destructive to one's career, just destructive to other things that maybe they don't care about much. But should people be at the liberty to destroy things they don't care about much? Well,
when did the book come out?
About 2 years ago.
Did he
2 or 3 years ago.
Refer to the 88. People in California who were saying that once you're cured you can go back to drink, and that about 70 years ago.
Well, he's not saying everybody holds the view that he's attacking.
but there's data on people who advocated, once you get control of your alcoholism, you can go back to drinking.
Yeah. But AA doesn't say that.
AA does not.
Yeah.
But you've read the follow-ups on that one, haven't you?
Well, I read reviews of it, and I'm not up to date on that. That's what I was asking.
And he does.
What are the follow-ups?
Well, it's been just hashed over and over and over and over and over again, but that many of the people that they thought were drinking moderately and had control of their lives really didn't. And that a part of their own disease was to present this deception.
Mm-hmm. And manipulation of part of alcoholics is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yes?
Who is this?
He's a professor of philosophy at University of California, Santa Barbara. And he's eminent credential. He's a philosopher who's spent a lot of time studying sciences, especially medical sciences, about what evidence they have for their claims that certain things are diseases and what what the notion of a, what the, how the procedure of developing a theory, say in psychiatry, differs from the logical way a theory is developed in physics. He's a philosopher of science of sorts. And he's been employed by the World Alcohol Institute and a whole host of organizations. He's got a lot of credentials. He's not widely known in the philosophical community. He's widely known in all these other communities that rely on his analysis contribution.
So then what he's trying to say is that because of the disease concept, it's unacceptable because somehow, some way, God gave us the technology and the ability to find cures. And so then what he's saying is that he can't morally accept the fact that he can't come up with an idea or a cure for something that he has no understanding about. So then more or less what he's trying to say is that it's unacceptable for man to accept defeat in the eyes of something that can be so small. So is that what he's trying to say, is that he can't accept defeat over a disease?
He's saying it's not a disease.
Yeah, so then he's not...
He's not saying, this is a disease and we don't have to accept defeat, we can lick it. He's saying it's not a disease.
So then
it's a personal problem, which is very complex and often very difficult to cure.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't really use the term cure, because symptom, cure, cause, at least when you think of cause of the disease, are all medical terms and are all misleading. Because they distract us from the true source of and role that alcoholism
plays. But the problem is we don't have appropriate language to put on it.
Yeah. That's your point would be we fell into that language not because we positively thought that language was correct, because we didn't have better language.
And nobody was calling it something comparable to cancer. Well, actually, cancer is one of the best analogies, because a lifestyle produces many kinds of cancer.
Not all.
But
and once you have it, it's clearly biologically based.
Yeah.
And one can do physiological things, or maybe can't, but if we could.
You can do a physiological thing, but you can also do many psychological things to slow it down. It's not a good analogy, but medically it's one of the best ones as far as disease.
Well, he would, I'm sure, admit that cancer is a disease and it's biologically based, even if it's partially psychologically caused.
Yeah.
But he's saying that alcoholism, he suspects, is not biologically based, and he says at least there's no good evidence so far that it is, and secondly that it's not a true compulsion. There is no full loss of control.
Does he refute the studies? I just perused the book. I didn't read it that carefully. Does he refute the studies about the tests that they've done where certain people's endorphin rate, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but
the so-called
people,
brain, the what happens in the brain when some people take a couple of drinks compared to other people, what happens in the brain when other people
take. Physiological difference in the way the chemistry responds to alcohol in some people.
He doesn't respond to that specifically, but I would guess that what he would say is that doesn't defeat his claim that there's still no loss of control. People vary in their physiological reactions to all sorts of things, and which doesn't mean that they lose control. It may mean that it's more difficult,
right.
And it may mean that it's a more complex problem to get a hold of. It also doesn't mean that it's a disease.
What does he mean by a disease?
Yeah.
There are thousands of diseases you can have not lose control.
Well, the mere fact that certain things happened at a higher rate in the brain reactions to alcohol in one person than in another would not make alcoholism a disease in that first person compared to the second. After all, different things happen in my brain when I eat chocolate compared to other people who don't like chocolate when they eat chocolate. There are all kinds of, he's assuming that there, throughout life, there are all kinds of things that are happening in the brain different in one person who desires something more than another person who desires it less. It doesn't show that the desire, the strong desire for whatever it is that the person who desires the thing more has, is a disease. Chocoholism isn't a disease, presumably.
Oh, it's an addiction.
It's addiction, but it's not a disease. He doesn't deny that it's an addiction. An addiction is just something that it is very difficult to get out of. That is where once you're in it, it seems reasonable to stay in it given the pain of getting out of it.
Well, your body physiologically alters itself.
He doesn't deny that it's an addiction. That there may be even some physiological components of an addiction.
But isn't the primary thing about a disease the fact that if it is not treated, it leads to death?
Progressive, fatal.
The main reason I think we're saying, finger at you've got only one notion of disease and there are other notions of disease, or please tell us what a disease precisely is. And he would say, well, maybe I don't want to make any claims about disease, that alcoholism is or isn't a disease, but what I do want to claim is that people don't lose control completely. And first of all, and secondly, that the primary avenues of treatment should be not medical, but something else, more complex in a personal assessment. And thirdly, that the search for a cure should not be done by medical researchers, primarily. You know, maybe you put a little money into that, but you don't put the lion's share. That's what he's saying. Even if he said, hey, I don't want to attack the disease notion anymore because I realize disease hasn't been sufficiently defined by either me or my critics to carry on the debate. I find him very unsatisfactory on that point. He hasn't defined what a disease is. He's just said what his target is and then attacked it.
And when you define what he's saying in that way, that treatment needs to be a total physical, emotional, spiritual healing, and that if you don't approach it spiritually, you're going to get nowhere, then you're right with AA, and you're right with the best treatment centers in the country.
Could be.
Many of which are not in hospitals.
Could be, but he'd still dispute the total loss of control. he notes that this is a very short book. It's in the bookstore, by the way. I'm supposed to plug the books that are in the bookstore, and I really do mean to plug this. I think this is a provocative book. It may be dead wrong, but it's provocative. And it's simply written. And the pages are small, too. And it's only 140 pages. And it's a paperback, and you can... It's a quick, fairly quick read. And he apologizes in the introduction for being rather simplistic on a number of things, but he says, it's time to get his message out. And maybe he was quite careless in the way he put a lot of things, though I, for one, can't quite excuse his failure to define what a disease is, more broadly to start with.
Pragmatically, what's going to happen is, if this takes weight, is that all insurance companies are going to quit paying for any kind of treatment.
Medical insurance. Maybe that's, Fingerette would say, if that's part and parcel of getting us off this social habit of classifying this as a disease and putting our money into medical research on it and medical treatments for it, good. We'll have to find other ways to pay for it and other ways to insure for it. But it shouldn't be by the medical avenue.
Yeah, good luck, yeah.
John?
Yeah, does the author here, or maybe the people aware of any other writers who have drawn parallels between alcoholism and eating disorders, obesity and anorexia, are we looking at basically the same thing?
I'm sure he would be equally suspicious about certain eating disorders are diseases. We want to turn them into diseases. And he would say, wait a minute, you know. They're probably, his suspicion would be most of those things, I think, are not diseases. But again, we've got to know what his definition of a disease is to be clear what he's denying here. But in any case, what he wants to deny is that people are totally out of control. And he wants to deny that the primary avenues that we should be looking for in both treatment and research into cures are medical.
What's been the success rate to treating alcoholism by traditional psychotherapy? Psychological?
I don't know.
Anybody know?
I don't know. Dinner's here. Sorry. Stay around, come up, talk to each other, etc.
Thank you.